From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's one story that newspapers wish would go away. Newspaper circulation is plummeting. The Los Angeles Times is down 6.5% in a year. The Chicago Tribune, 6.6%. The Cleveland Plain Dealer, 5.2%. Across the country, newspapers are struggling to hold on to advertisers, to keep readers buying papers. Newspapers are cutting back on staff and on coverage to keep Wall Street satisfied. In the age of the internet and endless media options, competitors are many and the future unclear. Papers are hardly alone in uncertainty. Network TV news is struggling. Satellite is shaking up radio. But newspapers have been the country's journalistic workhorse. Their decline could endanger the big scoop that takes months to dig out and shakes up government or the business world. Or maybe it just brings on the bloggers. Tonight on Point, newspapers in trouble and the future of America's press bulwark. We begin tonight with a closer look at the numbers behind the headlines. David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent. I asked him if this is more of the same bad news big dailies have coped with for years, or if newspapers are now looking over a precipice.
I think that's the great question being faced by newspapers and newspaper executives across the country. Certainly, these are among the worst numbers in quite a long time. If you look at daily newspapers, on average of the 800 American papers surveyed, they were down nearly 2% in daily circulation, down about 2.5% for Sunday circulation. That's a steep decline. Think about these circulation rates. They're what's used to determine the charges that are levied against advertisers. So if you see circulation comes down, advertising rates over time will probably have to decrease. They also are sort of used, many publicly traded companies that own newspapers use these formulas to say, okay, you can have a certain number of employees per a certain level of circulation. So for example, an extremely crude rule of thumb used by some newspaper companies would be one employee for every 1,000 in circulation. Well, if you lose 20,000 in circulation, suddenly you got to shed some employees too.
So circulation down 2.1%, but at some very big and well-known American newspapers, it was worse than that. Take us on a kind of a tour across the landscape here. Who's lost what?
Well, if you look at the New York Times, they've managed to build themselves into a national franchise. And in fact, they saw tiny increases both for daily and Sunday. But the Los Angeles Times, down 6.5% in daily circulation and 7.9% on Sundays. That's
a
tremendous loss. If you look at the Chicago Tribune, which is, I believe, the sixth largest newspaper in the country, eighth if you take out
if you include
the others. But it's lost about 6.2% daily. It's lost a little under 5% on Sundays. Again, those are very significant. San Francisco Chronicle has actually increased its quality in recent years. It's heavy investments by the privately held Hearst Newspapers Company. It's lost a little over 6% on daily and 7.8%. And it's not as though, you know, Los Angeles, the Bay Area are losing population. It's not as though they've totally imploded in terms of the economics, although there have been some business pressures, the loss of local industries, what have you, that contribute to that. But nonetheless, these are vibrant areas and they're losing circulation and they're increasing population. There's something that doesn't jibe. It's a source of incredible anxiety for publishers, and it will have a very bottom line effect.
And right behind those, Houston Chronicle down 3.9%, Boston Globe down 3.9%, Atlanta Journal-Constitution 2.4%, Washington Post 2.7%. Losses, losses, losses. Are people leaping out the windows? What's the industry's response?
Well, the industry is sort of quietly saying what it's been saying at panel discussions and corporate retreats all along. We have to think of new ways of doing business. They are pointing to the idea of readership. That is, instead of thinking about paid subscription levels, which is what circulation is, they want to convince advertisers and others to think about how many people are actually consuming the news product that they're producing. And there's a legitimate case to be made for that. A free online website doesn't get counted towards paid circulation levels. So their news staff are providing reporting that is read by people in that metro area, but it's not counted towards subscription levels. It is counted in terms of the modest income that can be generated from online ads currently, but they haven't felt out a way to build a model that advertisers for the main newspaper are subsidizing that as well.
That must be a tough sell because, of course, not all those advertisers are online, and they've been judging newspapers by this yardstick for many, many years. So they must feel like, why should they change now? Is it going to bottom line problems for newspapers? Are we seeing losses, newsroom cutbacks as a result of the circulation losses?
Absolutely. I mean, you're seeing that in newspapers across the country through attrition, through early buyouts. Newspapers' coverage is being, I think you can argue, affected by the loss in circulations over time. Understand that newspapers are probably, as an industry, as profitable or more profitable than ever. The 90s were a decade in which newspapers, as an industry, came to believe, led by publicly traded companies like Gannett and Knight Ridder and Tribune, to the notion that they should be making 20 to 30% or more profit margins for each of their newspapers. That's extraordinarily high.
Huge.
It used to be that newspapers used to accept maybe something in the low teens or 10%. Other industries, many other major industries, would be happy to have profit margins in the high single digits. So it's not as though newspapers are going out of business. It's that newspapers are trying to reconcile the extremely high profit margins that they are seeking, and increasing profit margins that they're seeking, I might add, with the loss in circulation, which affects their ability to charge advertisers the high rates they're accustomed to.
Are they making the case, David, that they're going to affluent sector of society so they don't need as many readers to be valuable, that they may not have the same mass readership, but it's the folks with money, so stick with us, you'll be fine?
That's a case I've certainly heard, more in private than in public. I mean, I think at the moment newspaper executives are using almost any argument they can get their hands on.
And if newspapers as a source of news become diminished, functionally diminished, the overall impact for the American press?
Well, I mean, if you watch the nightly newscasts, if you look at the major stories, most of them, not all, but most of them are driven by newspaper coverage. And newspapers have tended to be the place for the most authoritative textualized coverage, whether it's in a small city or whether it's internationally. As the economic model for subsidizing that withers, it's entirely possible we'll see a constriction of that coverage. We certainly have been in some of the cities that have been, you know, home to some of the most proud newspapers across the country, if you look at places like Miami or some of the more prestigious Knight Ridder newspapers. You could see a constriction of that, and I think it does affect the knowledge citizens have of the communities and society in which they live.
We're going to look more at that. David Folkenflik, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Glad to join you.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about newspapers in trouble, plummeting circulations, uneasy advertisers, and the uncertain future of America's press bulwark. You can join the conversation. In the age of time famine and the web, is the daily paper old hat? And what keeps you there, or what sent you packing? And what's lost if we lose newspapers? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Jay Rosen. He's chair of the journalism department at New York University and author of What Are Journalists For? He is also author of PressThink.org, a weblog about journalism. Jay Rosen, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So this conversation has been out there for years, but this steep decline in these latest numbers has got tongues wagging again. What's going on here? Is there a tipping point? Is there a point at which newspapers can't deliver on their journalistic promise, can't deliver to their corporate masters? Where do they stand?
Oh, I think this is a moment when the entire thing is sort of unraveling and starting to break apart. The numbers are partly a result of long-term shifts continuing, but they're really a result of the newspaper being forced to be more accountable in the way that it accounts for sales and figures and numbers. And really, it's shifting now to a different kind of argument about who's reading it and why, because the previous system is not only falling into disrepair, but it's unbelievable. It lost credibility. And what I think is fascinating is that you have different crises of believability going on at the same time as you have a shift in platform and a kind of breakup of the market, as well as political difficulties. So this is what's making the current moment in the press such a fascinating one, but also such a perilous one for the standard institutions.
The ground moving under newspapers on many fronts. The first crisis of believability that you're pointing to there is simply around circulation numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very prominent scandals at a number of newspapers that weren't giving straight numbers and
right.
got called on it, and that forced them to recalculate, and that often meant downward.
Yes, but it also showed sort of what they were willing to do to their customers. It soured relationships with some very key people in the community, and it lent an air of almost of corruption to the numbers, because we would be worrying about the long-term health of the industry a lot sooner if the numbers had been more honest, that there was something of keeping back the truth from themselves, from their critics, from Wall Street, from advertisers. And for a newspaper, a journalist in the business of truth, to be withholding the truth about themselves and their business, it's not your ordinary accounting error. And that's part of the crisis here.
At that point, it bleeds over into the fundamental mission. At the same time, as you say, new platforms, the web above all, are pushing in.
Yeah, I think part of the reason why they inflated the numbers, frankly, was that when the numbers were more honestly counted, the sense that this isn't working anymore, our strategy is broken, we really have to kind of go back to square one, we have to rethink how we've tried to survive, that would have all come flooded in a lot earlier. And I think the people involved weren't so much corrupt and sort of stealing money from people. They were trying to hold back the world in a way.
And hold on to a model, to a kind of journalism, to an institution. Jay Rosen, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about newspapers in trouble. Listeners, you can join us. Why is newspaper circulation plummeting across the country? In the age of time famine and the web, is the daily paper just old hat? Have your newspaper reading habits changed? And if you've dropped the paper, what might draw you back? Would anything? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about newspapers in trouble, plummeting circulation, uneasy advertisers, and the uncertain future of America's press bulwark, or at least what has been that. You can join the conversation tonight. Younger listeners, have you ever subscribed to a newspaper? And are you all internet all the time? What's lost when newspapers lose ground? And who will do the reporting if we're left with blogs and online news summaries? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from New York by Jay Rosen, chair of the journalism department at New York University and author of the web blog PressThink.org. We're joined now from Washington by Geneva Overholzer. She's former ombudsman at the Washington Post, was on the editorial board of the New York Times, former editor of the Des Moines Register. She's currently a professor of journalism at the University of Missouri's School of Journalism. Geneva Overholzer, thanks for being with us tonight.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So here, Jay's describing a situation where everything's in flux. We're looking at these sort of eye-opening new numbers, just the latest in years of losses, but big losses this time. Jay Rosen says, look around. Everything's quaking here, not just the circulation numbers, but a sense of trust, a sense of place in the press world. How do you describe the health of newspapers?
Well, I have to say, I'm glad you're doing this show because it's an important time, and for all of us who love newspapers and who worry about what's going to pay for journalism, if something worse happens with newspapers, it's an important moment. But I got to say, I don't think we should overstate the case. I'm hearing unraveling and plummeting and everything's shaking, and your own intro with David Folkenflik, which was very good, mm-hmm. noted that half of Americans do read newspapers every day. It's a pretty healthy institution in many ways, makes a whole lot of money. And the second point I think we ought to introduce into the conversation, Tom, is that owners have been acting like newspapers had little future for a lamentably long time, and cutting staffs and cutting newshull even as they produce those amazing profit margins. Mm. So I think in some ways what we're seeing here is the result of years of having very little research and development, years of doing very little training, years of really not investing, but rather treating newspapers as a kind of cash cow. And if these numbers make people look up and say, wow, we need to worry about this, then frankly, I'm sort of glad to see them.
Geneva, I hear you saying two things at once there. On the one hand, there's been cost cutting and an impact of that. On the other, many people still do read papers. They still play an important role. I guess it's the trend line that's caught our eye here. It's been down on the circulation front for so long, and then this precipitous drop. And Of course, you know, people have a decade ago, when the web came on stream, people were talking about the end of newspapers, and here they still are. Yet, how long can this kind of trend go on without some dire consequence for at least the printed news every day?
Well, they've been talking about it since the birth of the telegraph, and then the radio, and then the TV, and then online. I don't mean to diminish this. It's important, but I think there are other things that are happening as well. Newspapers are going online. There are important presences online. These free newspapers, which are a very important phenomenon, respond to an increasing expectation, I think particularly from young people, perhaps, that they're going to get their news for free. So it seems like a lot of things are out there being questioned. And for me, the real concern, again, comes down to whatever happens, we as citizens need to worry about some kind of economic model that is going to have institutions that pay for journalism, because it's a very expensive undertaking.
Jay Rosen, how do you see it? Geneva says let's not overstate the decline of newspapers. They're still filling an important role. A lot of people still reading them. But she also concedes the economic challenge that you've described, but you described even more flux than that. So, you know, is this a problem that's really not that bad, or are papers headed to the boneyard?
Well, I think what concerns me, what makes it more than an ordinary time of difficulty, is that this is a business, an industry, a culture, a professional culture that really hasn't had success in transforming itself. It hasn't invested, as Geneva said, in its people, in intellectual capital. It is, in many ways, a backwater of American life, and this is one of the consequences of having a monopoly status in many communities. The world of newspaper journalism is one that's really rooted in the industrial era, and those attitudes of production, daily production, and the fantastic act of coordination that the newspaper represented were products of an earlier era in American life. I haven't seen the kind of flexibility, the kind of zero-based thinking, the kind of creativity that would be needed for newspapers to convert their considerable strengths, which do remain, into new credibility, a new kind of authority online. I don't see that happening. I see a need for it, a hunger for it, but sometimes organizations grow in such a way that they cannot transcend themselves. And that is why I see this as a problem, more a greater problem than just sort of figuring out a new market. It's learning how to think again about your situation. And it's really hard for old organizations to do that.
A kind of state of mind. On the other hand, as long as they are still putting out 40 or 50 million newspapers a day, Jay Rosen, that is a huge production challenge in the old style.
Absolutely, but it may be that the world is changing in such a way that this amazing act is no longer affordable, or it has to be done in another way. I think the newspaper industry right now should be asking itself, why can't we take that huge investment in printing and trucking and distribution and put that into the editorial product by cutting our distribution costs to zero online? That's what I would be attracted to doing.
I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Tom is calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. Very interesting discussion. And a little full disclosure, I actually work in online media.
What capacity, Tom?
I am the executive director of the Online News Association, which is an organization that's kind of devoted full-time to looking at issues about online news.
So are you the competitor then, or you're just another face of newspapers?
I think we're another face. I mean, we have many members in our organization who don't work for Jay, for instance, who don't work full-time for newspapers. But many of our members and the people who started our organization were all members of large news newspapers, in fact.
So how do you see the future of newspapers, Tom? Do you see them sticking around, being important for a long time, or are you making them dinosaurs? or will they prevail in your realm, online?
Well, I think the answer is a little bit of both. I actually think that, and the people I've talked to about this have come up with some interesting analogies, and the two that stick with me the most are that, you know, newspapers could become either like horses or like radio, in the sense that, you know, there are more horses in the United States right now than there were in the 19th century.
In the horse and buggy days.
Exactly. But they cost a lot more to keep. They cost a lot more to maintain, and only the people who really want them are willing to pay for them. And I think we might move towards a model where they will continue to be print products, but they're going to cost a lot more money, and basically you're going to pay to get the news in the format, in a particular format. And if you want it in print, you're just going to have to pay more to get it in print.
So subscribers would pony up. And the radio analogy?
Well, you know, radio started off as drama, and then TV came along, and of course they had to find something new, so they found more music. And then that was really taken over by FM. And you know, now really when you listen to radio, AM in particular, it's talk. So, you know, maybe newspapers can look at it in the same way, in the sense that as radio learned to adapt and find a new audience, I think newspapers will do the same thing. I think you will see newspapers become much more analytical in the sense of the way they write about things rather than breaking news.
Analytical or political, we've also seen.
Yeah, you know, that could be. But the sense is that if you look at the times, Tom, when people have time to read, which are primarily Saturday and Sunday mornings in particular, that's the time they have to sit down and look at a newspaper. And when you look at the kind of papers that come out on Sunday, whether it's the Globe or the Times or whoever, it's a much more thoughtful, you know, sort of deeper experience, not so much oriented towards breaking news so much, but a lot of other stuff as well.
Tom, you've given us a lot to think about there. Let me put it to Geneva Overholzer, if I may. Geneva, what about that? First, do you see papers as the new horse, you know, sort of you keep them in your private paddock and pay a lot for them? And I guess the other point that both Jay and our caller Tom Riggin have raised, the evolutionary path of newspapers. Do you see them successfully evolving into new media?
Well, they've been trying to evolve on the front of being more analytical, as our caller said. They certainly are. Some people complain that, in fact, they sound cynical because they're analytical and they're not just giving us straight news anymore. It's possible they'll do that horse number that he was talking about. Some media in Germany, for example, the amount of money that comes from circulation is much higher than it is here. Here, about 80% of a newspaper's revenue comes from advertising. Mm-hmm. So we really aren't charging much for the consumer, and it's possible it will become more of an elitist thing. For those of us who worry about how we are going to be informed as citizens, I think that doesn't sound like a great future. As far as online, newspapers certainly have immigrated online, and many newspapers have very powerful and important websites. But unlike Jay, I can't see that it would be wise for them to give up what is an extremely important manner of delivery now, and which I think some people, it'd be interesting to know if our recent caller would agree with this, but I think people say at Google or Yahoo or all the places that are competing with newspapers would say that they wish they did have that additional method of delivery, which can appeal to advertisers in different ways and from which you can draw people online and draw people online back to the printed product. So I can't imagine, you know, baby boomers love baby boomers, and I'm kind of in the leading edge of them at 57, love newspapers. And we're going to grow old and retire, and the rest of the boom will follow us. And I just don't think printed newspapers are going to be gone in my lifetime.
Not gone, but a lot of disgruntlement and certainly a lot of change going on out there.
There always is.
Of course, it's the world as we know it. Yet for newspapers, this may be a little more than they had for a long time there. We're joined now from New York by Lori Garrett. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She was health and science reporter for Newsday. Last March, she wrote a long goodbye to her colleagues at Newsday that was quite critical of the newspaper as she left. She's currently senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lori Garrett, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening.
We've seen the letter that you shared with your colleagues, and you were leaving in, I don't know, you describe it, anger, sorrow. This is a very hot letter and a very critical letter about what's happened with American newspapering. Why have you left?
I think it's getting harder and harder and harder to do anything that is remarkable or interesting or important or vital journalism, not because of some of the things I was hearing some of your other guests talk about, but because of the nature of the financial structure of media. And I think this is as true for television and radio as it is for newspapers and magazines, and is likely to eventually be the case for all of the most successful online news sites as well.
You say the sad arc of greed has finally hit bottom. honesty and tenacity have taken back seats to snappy news, sensationalism, scandal for the sake of scandal, and you conclude this is terrible for democracy. Have you really seen that significant a change in the course of your career?
Absolutely. I mean, astonishing. And, of course, I happen to have worked for a corporation that went through a series of morphs and changes that created a kind of extreme version of all this. But what we've seen in the last 25 years is that most of the news organizations in this country, other than public broadcasting, have been swallowed up by ever larger corporations, so that the sort of family-run newspaper is an antique and all but non-existent in most of the United States today. And that goes for Canada and Europe as well. And the relatively small independent broadcasters are all but disappearing and being swallowed up by very, very large corporate broadcasting conglomerations of one kind or another. And they, in turn, have been swallowed up by companies that have diverse product lines and perceive news as a product that must compete in terms of profit and the sort of contribution to the bottom line and the stock valuation of the corporation against such things as detergent, automobiles, electrical power plants, and other things that the same corporation makes through various other subsidiary companies.
And the impact of that on the kind of reporting we get, in your view?
Well, I mean, when they started telling us at Newsday that the newspaper had to turn a 30% annual profit, and back in the good old days, you thought you had a hugely profitable newspaper if you hit 9%. All that means is that you got to cut your newsroom down to the bare bones. You have to get rid of all your foreign operations. You have to stop doing the kind of in-depth news coverage, analytical news coverage. You can't afford anymore to have reporters work 4 months on a story and not appear in the paper during those 4 months. You cut to the cut to the cut to the cut, until you haven't got anybody left to produce the news, cover the news, and give the American people what they need to know.
You write, it's damn tough to find that truth every day with a mere skeleton crew of reporters and editors. You say that you've been in 47 states since 9/11, and quoting you, I can attest to the horrible impact the deterioration of journalism has had on the national psyche. What do you mean?
Well, in most of the country today, you're hard-pressed to find anything that constitutes local news coverage, and that's as true in broadcast as in print. And online, you're almost devoid of serious local news that can actually tell you, you know, who's corrupt in your state legislature, who's stealing from the mayor's kitty, you know, in your local town and what have you. And when you get up to the national level, everybody's being spoon-fed from the same giant pots of information, whether it be the Knight Ritter pot, the Gannett USA Today pot, the Tribune News Service pot, the Clear Channel pot, the Fox pot, whatever it may be.
So it's a lot of pots.
Instead of having thousands of reporters and editors and news organizations all competing to try and get fresh slants and perspectives on a story, you have a very, very homogenized and very tiny, finite set.
There's Lori Garrett with a report from the trenches as she walks away from the trenches, former Pulitzer Prize winner. Lori Garrett, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Geneva Overholzer, there is a very angry voice from the battlefront who's just walking away. What do you think of that critique?
Well, it sounds exactly like me 10 years ago when I left being editor of the Des Moines Register. It's heartbreaking and absolutely true, and it's part of what I mean about how owners have been treating newspapers as if they were just cash cows for years. And I think it's finally coming, it's becoming more public now. I actually feel more hopeful than I did 10 years ago, if only because you can't go on lamenting forever, you know.
Absolutely.
But also because there are some good things happening. I mean, the web is an exceedingly lively place. Now, again, it's not people doing, as Lori noted, you know, we're not getting a lot of hard-digging reporting on your state legislatures at the web. On the other hand, you're getting a lot of interesting information and a lot of people who are making newspapers better. So, I mean, 10 years ago, when I felt so heartsick about the kind of profit pressures and how they were starving newsrooms, I didn't see a lot of hopeful news abroad in the land. Now I see more. And frankly, one of the pieces of news I see that's hopeful is that we're seeing the impact on newspapers, and some owners are looking alive because of it.
Geneva Overholzer, Jay Rosen, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about newspapers in trouble. Listeners, what's your prognosis for the newspaper? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about newspapers in trouble, plummeting circulation, uneasy advertisers, and the uncertain future of America's press bulwark. You can join the conversation tonight. Who will do the reporting if we're left with blogs and online news summaries? Or do you welcome the more democratic information ethos of the Internet? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight from New York by Jay Rosen, chair of the Journalism Department at New York University, author of PressThink.org, a weblog. And Geneva Overholzer joins us from Washington. She's former ombudsman at the Washington Post. She's currently a professor at the University of Missouri's School of Journalism. Right now, we're joined from San Francisco by Peter Appert. He's a media analyst for Goldman Sachs. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Appert.
Good evening.
We've heard very sharp criticism of the kind of profit motive that's been working through newspapers this evening. You're sort of the go-to guy for how those profits are going to go. Just as a business, how do you see the future of newspapering?
You know, I guess I'd be more sympathetic to the accusation of profit-mongering if, in fact, the profits were better. The profitability of the newspaper industry has declined substantially in the last couple of years in the context of the sloppy ad market, the declining circulation revenues, the pressure on operating margins.
Of course, the complaint we've heard tonight was that people were reaching for 25 or 30%, that was unreasonable, and maybe it's something more reasonable. Now, do investors look at it that way?
Oh, 25 to 30. Those were the good old days, and it's been quite some time since we were at that level, unfortunately. I think from the investor perspective, there is a widely held view that the profitability of the newspaper industry, and frankly, more broadly, the profitability of the traditional local media business, I'll throw TV and radio in there as well, have declined significantly in recent years in the context of all the fragmentation we're seeing in the marketplace. And frankly, you know, my view as an analyst is that that's probably not going to change.
So does that mean this becomes less attractive? Does that mean that profit pressures diminish because people don't have the same expectations out of the media, out of newspapers?
I don't know that profit pressures diminish, but I do think that the profitability, as I said, of the industry is permanently reduced, and I think therefore investor interest in the sector is probably permanently reduced as well.
Off goes the monopoly, a lot of fracturing, and there goes that some of that interest. Peter Appert at Goldman Sachs, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure.
I want to get to our very patient callers who have been waiting to get in here. Marie's calling from Jersey City, New Jersey. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment. I'm part of the younger online-only generation, and I know that I entirely have an expectation of news being free. But when turning to the web, do look for recognizable mainstream news names, such as the New York Times, to go to their websites. I don't know how that falls in with their profitability, but I know that, personally, that's how I would seek out news.
Jay Rosen, here's Marie. She goes to the web and she goes to newspapers, but she expects it to be free. Will that ultimately work or not?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we do know that the whatever's causing her to say, yeah, New York Times, I want to go there because of this built-up reputation is an extremely valuable thing, and it certainly is the basis for a future economy of news. And that's why some of us are optimistic that something can emerge. But I would add that just because an industry doesn't find it profitable to pay for news gathering doesn't mean that that necessarily is going away. There are other ways to support it. The industry gave up more or less on radio journalism, and it's now supported through things like NPR. It's like another sector took that one over. And I think this is the way we have to think these days, because I have no confidence whatsoever that the investor community cares about whether journalism lives or dies. And so we have to be realists about that.
So maybe what matters is what Marie thinks. Marie, if those established news sources that you go to online began to charge, do you think your peers would just drift away? Can you imagine a time where you'd pay something, or do you expect to never pay for news?
I believe a minimal payment, but then in contrast to print media, there's always the huge TV sources that someone did mention. They do all seem to be owned by, you know, a few group of people, but I know that is, I would essentially go to CNN after and New York Times, I don't believe they have as much print media, so I would turn to a different type of multimedia with the same type of name recognition.
We got it. Marie, thanks very much for your call. Geneva Overholzer, of course, newspapers would like to charge for what's online. There's been talk about it. Do you see that happening? Do you see a revenue stream there that could come in and support the breadth and depth of journalism that's been done traditionally with the paper product?
It seems to me nobody really knows that yet. A lot of people are trying to figure that out. The Wall Street Journal, of course, charges, and I read recently, you probably saw this, that the New York Times is thinking of charging for its archive, which is a very valuable resource, of course.
Or there's also talk of them charging for a premium service if you go deeper on a particular story.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll see more of that, and of course we'll also understand more about what advertisers are willing to support online. And I agree with Jay's point. We may see support for journalism arising from elsewhere. You've mentioned NPR, Jay, we've also, you know, there are a couple of newspapers that are actually supported by institutions, the St. Pete Times in Florida by the Poynter Institute. You've got the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit here in Washington, doing important investigative work, in part because it saw that so many newspapers were not doing it anymore. But who's going to support local investigative news, I wonder?
Jay Rosen?
I think there are methods. I think we're going to see a variety of ways of doing it. I think raising money through the internet for projects in journalism is totally feasible, and we'll start to see that. I think we'll start to see rich local people who want good journalism in their community figure out how to do it more in a donor or patron way. I think there might be an explosion, frankly, of economic systems to go with an explosion of journalistic forms. That's what I'm looking for, because I have no trust that the media industry is actually going to carry journalism and news into the next platform.
Can you see that going down to the local level, Geneva?
Well, it seems to me, if I could just note, Tom, one explosion we've seen is partisan journalism, which is paid for. A lot of people like this, what's called journalism of affirmation, kind of. You know, you tune into whatever will agree with you.
Affirm my worldview, please.
Yeah. You know, I think that could be increasingly what we see, because it is a supported form.
The country's seen that before the 19th century. Does it fulfill what we need from journalism today, or would it?
Well, it's easy to see what's wrong with it, and I agree with most of the things we would all say is wrong. I must say, that was an era when people were very much engaged in political life. Voting, a higher proportion of citizens voted. I don't mean it was cause and effect, but I don't know that we ought to raise our hands. What I worry about is media that is ideologically driven but pretends not to be. That, I think, is dangerous.
Such as?
Fox News, which in the past, you know, here they've been contending they were the only fair and balanced medium, and too many mainstream media were afraid to just call them on it and say, come on, they do some terrific news, they're a really interesting show, sometimes they're straight down, but it's clear that they lean right, and it's important to say that. Now that sort of comes as a given, but, you know, 2 years ago, nobody was willing to say that, and I think that's bad, because we can't have a sort of a deceitful presentation that way, I think.
Be political if you like, but say so. Let's get one more call. Yeah. Laura's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an artist in a, I work two full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't own a TV. I get all my news from NPR. And I tried recently to get a subscription to get local news, exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
NPR is generally more international, I'm finding. Mm-hmm. Definitely not in the Boston area, per se, or a town.
How'd it work out?
I had to stop because it kept going in the recycling bin because I had no time. They even gave me free coffee, but I couldn't take advantage of it. And I'm a purist. I'm an artist. I love text. I love photography. I love traditional photography. I won't do digital, you know. But the time and the effort and the quality, I hear the argument for that workhorse, that money involved mm-hmm. with that. You have to charge more.
But that big pile of paper and ink, you just didn't get through it. You didn't get
no,
to it.
No, but I could use it for artwork, but that's it. That's you know, a small percentage of us. But online, I think, is probably where I would go next.
And maybe to newspapers there, and maybe not. Laura, thanks very much for your call. Jay, you... Both of you really have a kind of optimism despite these circulation numbers, despite the complaints we're hearing that all these new media options are going to end up providing the news. At least I think that's what I hear you saying, Jay Rosen, even if the big workhorse isn't what it was, isn't distributed or read in the same way that it was.
Well, that's because two things, Tom. One is there's been a big shift in power, and in my view, the press is now co-owned. Partly by the media, partly by the nonprofit sector, and partly by citizens themselves, because the cost of becoming a publisher yourself has fallen so dramatically. And this is the other big development, is that many of the media tools have evolved into public hands. And so we're going to see a new birth of press freedom in the sense that many people can now contribute to the national conversation and the local conversation that way. That's exciting. Journalism is becoming more democratic. And at the same time, a lot of the forces that have dominated journalism and professionalized it too much, in my opinion, are in retreat. And the media industry is kind of abandoning journalism, which is in many ways a good thing. There's going to be a painful transition, but it's an exciting time.
A good thing to abandon journalism because you're saying it's going to be more democratic, less
no,
constrained by form.
No, because what Lori Garrett was saying, they basically failed to value this thing in any way that the society could recognize as public service. And the reasons for that are well understood. Once it becomes like any other use of capital in the media empire, it is hard to explain why you would invest in journalism. But other regimes may not have that difficulty. I think the media just kind of spun itself out. It became impossible to reproduce good journalism within a media structure. And so it's better that some other institution gets a crack at it.
So let the new energies flow in. Wow, it's a brave new world on many fronts. Jay Rosen, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Sure.
Jay Rosen, chair of the journalism department at NYU and author of the PressThink.org weblog, and Geneva Overholzer, former editor of the Des Moines Register, now at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thanks.
In a moment, a new Pentagon report says the U.S. military is overstretched. This is On Point. War in Iraq and Afghanistan has put the U.S. military at significant risk, quote-unquote, of being unable to deliver on Pentagon war plans elsewhere, the country's top uniformed officer warns this week. In a classified report to Congress, General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the military is overstretched. President Bush struck a far more optimistic tone at his press conference last week. The president was asked if the number of troops in Iraq limited America's capacity to respond to other potential military threats around the world.
The person I asked that to, at least, is to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, my top military advisor. I said, do you feel that we've limited our capacity to deal with other problems because of our troop levels in Iraq? And the answer is no. He doesn't feel we're limited. Feels like we got plenty of capacity.
Mark Mazzetti is Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He joins me now from Washington for a closer look. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So here we've got exactly that man that President Bush cites saying this week we do have an overstretch problem. Is there a contradiction between what the president said last week and what General Myers is saying now?
I think there's certainly a difference between what the president said and what is contained in General Myers' report to Congress, because General Myers is talking about the problems of capacity, of the limits to what the military can and can't do abroad. The president seemed to indicate that Myers said there's none of these problems, and Myers is saying that, you know, the United States can do the war in Iraq, can do the war in Afghanistan, but if it were asked to do anything else major around the world, it would have a tough time doing it. It should be said that Myers said any war that the United States was asked to take on, we could win. It would just be a lot different than what the Pentagon war plans call for.
It's a classified analysis for Congress. How do we know about it? Is a summary been put out?
No. There were a few reporters who gained access to it yesterday, talked to some Pentagon officials about what it contained, or at least some elements of the report. We have not seen the full classified report, but we do get the basic elements of what the conclusions were of the report.
So what can you tell us about the strains that General Myers is describing to Congress, the strains that are stretching the military?
Some are quite obvious. There's 140,000 troops in Iraq, and those rotate through on a yearly basis. So the ones just getting back from Iraq can't go anywhere immediately. The war in Afghanistan is placing strains on not only troops, but on stockpiles of weapons, on tanks, on ships, planes, that type of thing. And so you have these two very active wars going on. And the military, it would be very difficult for the military to commit a major amount of troops to another conflict, whether it be on the North, on the Korean Peninsula, or, God forbid, in Iran, any one of these things. It shows that the limits of even the most, powerful military in the world.
You quote a senior defense official saying the assessment is that he's saying that we'd ultimately succeed, but quoting him, there would be higher casualties and more collateral damage. That usually means civilian casualties. He says we would have to win uglier. What does that mean?
Well, I think in part it means that the Pentagon draws up these very detailed war plans, like we saw for Iraq. The first, 3 weeks of the war in Iraq, the march on Baghdad was meticulously planned, and it was meticulously planned to reduce the number of civilian casualties and to only take 2 to 3 weeks. And as we saw, it did. Now, there's been 2 years of an insurgency afterwards, but the war plan to get to Baghdad actually went pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're saying is if they had to do that again right now in another place, they wouldn't have the troops to, build up in for 3 months in the desert or wherever else, and be able to execute it in a way that would, limit the civilian damage and as well as the damage and the casualties to U.S. troops.
And that means it would be an uglier win. Mark, is it your sense that this is actively constraining U.S. policy, U.S. strategy around the world right now, whatever President Bush may say?
Well, it's certainly true that at the Pentagon you hear a lot less talk about solving problems militarily around the world. I think that there's a general concession to reality in the Pentagon that that the U.S. military couldn't take on another big thing around the world. Remember, immediately after the fall of Baghdad, you heard leaks or you heard some discussion that maybe Syria would be next, and maybe the military could turn west and go on Damascus and do a regime change there. You don't hear that talk anymore. You hear a lot of talk about trying to solve things diplomatically, which of course is the way you should be doing it, but there's just a whole lot less bluster at the Pentagon about what the military can do right now.
A reality check from the very top there. Mark Mazzetti, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Sure, thanks.
Mark Mazzetti with the Los Angeles Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.